QXQL calling CQ. Is there anyone on the air?
Beautiful senior industry for walking around that bar and dancing on that stage for you, wearing nothing but that lingerie. But our job is, if you'd rather see that, wear a t-shirt contest.
Andy Kane.
It appears to be a protest of some kind, and officials are describing the crowd as unruly.
Sad news. The powers that be have decreed that the F word is a word too far.
Eat your cereal with a fork. And do your homework in the dark.
Regret and remorse, amends and atonement.
Play with the shadows of the night. So baby, take my hand, it'll be alright. Surrender all your dreams to me tonight. They'll come true.
Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm... normal. You know, about the same.
Yeah.
Today I learned that after sweeping the 2004 Oscars, Peter Jackson and Elijah Wood skipped all official celebrations and went to a Lord of the Rings fan party. So, this episode, I suppose we owe the audience a discussion. We can't just let them listen to our private thoughts for an hour.
We could.
What kind of went down here is we were wanting to get a little back to basics after the our night out at the Oscars with our fancy gowns.
Speaking of us, who the hell are you?
Oh, this is Matt. I've done away with Cameron. Put him back in Oscar storage for a year.
It's really cool. It's just like a single morgue locker that we just kind of throw him on the slab and seal him in. Take him out as necessary.
Yeah, we put him in a Hannibal Lecter mask, and then we hook that mask up to, I don't know, Frogert.
And I,
we should actually,
by the way,
have him back sooner this time.
Yeah, we probably should. I, by the way, I'm Trevor Trujillo, and both Matt and I, we co-host this podcast together, if you haven't figured that out by now. And yeah, we meet here at the imaginary Nighthawks Diner, where people like to stay after midnight and have coffee and pie and talk about a few movies.
It works best if you picture your local diner. Might be a D's or a Denny's or an IHOP, or hopefully not an international place of omelets, because you don't want to go to an IPU. Perhaps it's Tom's Diner, just off the main drag in Denver. Perhaps it's some other diner.
Could be Norm's in L.A., to Cantor's Deli.
We can't fail to shout out the Kirby Lane.
Of course, Kirby Lane down in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, but you've got one in your town. And we'd like you to imagine you're in a booth with us, maybe silently judging the loud kids on the other side of the divider.
But you and I used to go to a place in Laramie called Sherry's, which, don't look for it, it's not there anymore, but that was kind of our late night to hang out for. What we were saying is we've got this long storied history of late night diners, and that was kind of the impetus of what we're doing, but... one of the things we specifically want to do with this episode is we want to hail and give a little love, give a little attention to an actor who we feel has done an excellent body of work, who hasn't gotten quite the attention that maybe, say, since we're coming off the Oscars, that an Emma Stone or a Denzel Washington has gotten. but something that we expect a lot of good things from these people, and these are people that we think need to be on your radar, maybe you're not familiar with, that we'd like to share with you. So
we did want to get back to some genre roots and just do some straight up sit and watch movies, let you off the think train a little bit. Watch some good old horror.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is going to be kind of an ongoing series. Just occasionally we'll find a performer or an auteur somewhere out there that we just like, hey, we're gonna celebrate this person for an episode. So this episode, I suggested that we do the movies of Justin Welborn. He's an actor. He's been in quite a bit of genre fare. He's got this a little bit of a Scream King thing going. He's a fantastic actor. He's been in several things that both of us have enjoyed over the years. So we selected two movies out of his filmography that we felt maybe didn't showcase him necessarily as a lead, but definitely kind of showcase a range. And a range in genre, a range in performance, a range in voice, a range in physicality. And so we selected the 2007 film The Signal and the 2008 film Dance of the Dead, neither of which are to be confused with other films by the same name, because there is a Masters of Horror episode done by, I think it was Toby Hooper, that was called Dance of the Dead. That's not this.
I had some Mandela effect issues with this because, to tell you the truth, I was a little confused when Trevor suggested The Signal. Because gun to my head, I would have sworn that Justin Welborn's part was played by a young Michael Shannon.
Well, and it doesn't help that there is also a 2014 film called The Signal with Olivia Cooke and Lawrence Fishburne. For my money, I'm not going to speak for Matt, but for my money, the 2007 Signal is definitely the superior Signal. And then Dance of the Dead, we'll talk about more in depth. The two Dance of the Dead by name films are very, very, very different. But
well, and so are the two Signals. Like the 2014 Signal is kind of a think piece bottle movie. It's about an involuntary first contact. They're unrelated. They're not remakes of each other. English runs out of titles. So.
And specifically, Justin Welborn is in both of these films. He's definitely more of a lead in The Signal, but these are also both very much ensemble pieces. So even though he's not the lead, he's definitely a very key, very pivotal role in both films.
Now, if you don't, if you can't immediately place Justin Welborn without Googling, the most significant, the probably most exposed role he's had, would you say that's Justified?
Yeah, I probably would. He was, I think it was seasons 5 and 6 that he kind of straddled on. And he had a recurring role as Carl Lennon, one of the heavies, one of the bad guys in the TV series Justified on FX that just wrapped up not too terribly long ago. Starring Timothy Oliphant as a no-nonsense, leather-slapping, gun-slinging U.S. Marshal, contending with his background in rural Kentucky. And some of the criminal element that has sprung up since he's been gone.
Well, and interestingly enough, before Justified was a thing, this episode might have been about his boss in Justified, Walton Goggins, who's another person that just kind of works a lot and sneaks in and steals what he's in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Walton Goggins. I love Timothy Oliphant in Justified. And actually, Justin Welborn and Timothy Oliphant were also in the remake of The Crazies, which was like the second, I wouldn't say Dawn of the Dead was better than the original, but it was the second George Romero remake that was kind of like, oh, hey, this is, I was not expecting this to be good, but it was. You've definitely seen Justin Welborn around. And if you haven't, you need to. And I think there's probably no better way than to jump in on these two films that we've got today. Matt, had you seen either of these previous to this?
I know for a fact I had seen The Signal, and I believe I had seen Dance of the Dead was one of those, what was that, the Ghost House or whatever? It was an anthology. It wasn't quite, I don't think it was ever on TV, so it's not exactly like Masters of Horror. But it's another one you see where they attempted some branding around their releases.
When it was released on DVD, it was released under the Ghost House Underground label, which during their kind of initial rollout had some familiar and unique markings on their DVDs to kind of group them together as a kind of a pseudo collection. You saw this a lot with other properties too. I believe there was like the series 8 Films to Die For that were like a special theatrical release that then they released on DVD afterwards. To kind of group these together is maybe a sales gimmick or something. I'm not sure that it entirely worked.
It sort of felt like they were, because Ghost House is Sam Raimi and Robert Tappert, his frequent collaborator. And so they were, it sort of felt to me like a farm team for their theatrical releases. Almost a scouting system where they were trying to get some movies out and develop some talent.
The label, the DVD label, was a kind of a direct-to-video. I think it was 8 titles, and they were handpicked by Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert. You had other movies like Brotherhood of Blood with Ken Forey, Dark Floors, Room 205, Last House in the Woods, The Substitute, and Dance of the Dead. I think Dance of the Dead is honestly the best out of all the 8. The way I first came to Dance of the Dead was at South by Southwest, and even then, it was kind of sparking a lot of attention. It was like, hey, if you want to see something really special from a filmmaker that's going to go places, you need to check this out. And as a result, it kind of became a hard ticket. We were very fortunate that we got in, as a matter of fact. We saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse Ritz, which is downtown on 6th Street, Austin's famous bar district. And it was a very happy, very jovial screening. Most of the cast was there. Justin Wellborn was there. And even during a pivotal climax of the movie, there was a large explosion. And because this was their premiere screening, the cast and crew were up in the balcony and actually threw confetti during the explosion, which was kind of a neat effect, honestly. So I don't know. Maybe I have a little bias when I'm judging the film, but it is one that I care very, very, very dearly for. Matt, how did it treat you? Were you fond of this one?
It was a little slow out of the gate for me. It took me a minute to figure out that it was more of a like a horror comedy. The setup here is a sort of a zombie outbreak on prom night.
You know, we went through kind of a real tropey period where zombies were hot. I'm not going to say that zombies are easy to do because they're easy to do poorly. I think when zombies are done well, it's a feat. It's something that not everybody can do.
It has a kind of proto handheld feel.
Mm-hmm.
This was a little bit before the utter heyday of reality TV or reality.
Kind of a more found footage verite style. Yeah.
But it's got a few of the little techniques in it. And I was a little bit like, I don't quite know what I'm looking at here. And then I started to kind of get what was going on, especially right around the time the zombies show up. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. I get what we're doing now.
So when you look at it, though, culturally speaking, the kind of ebb and flow of the popularity of the zombie film. This came at about a time where there was a lot of people doing zombies poorly. It's because they thought you could just do a fill-in-the-blank, where it's a zombie movie but X. And we've talked about that a little bit before on other episodes, but it's a zombie movie but it's the Old West. It's a zombie movie but they're skateboarders. It's a zombie movie but you're on the moon, or you're in space, or, you know, you're in the hood, whatever. And this really easily could have been just a generic, boring bottle movie in a gymnasium with kids at a prom. But that's not what this movie does. And what we have is kind of a weird Venn diagram overlap where we have a very funny and very well thought out and very well realized parody of the teenage coming of age movie that was kind of popular around this time. You look at your...
Yeah, I think that's kind of why I didn't dial it in too tight,
mm-hmm.
is because teen movies and zombie movies are both less common than they were when someone decided it was worthy of a skewering.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. It is a capable parody of a teen film. It's a capable parody of a zombie movie. And then they have taken those two concepts and then glued them together in an interesting fashion. And so I think this is why this functions much better than, say, a smaller budget zombie movie or a similarly budgeted zombie movie from the time.
I know this is last minute, but will you please go to the prom with me?
Ew, get lost, Jimmy. You will remember tonight. Your prom ticket.
We don't have dates to the prom.
I was gonna go, but then my day ate bad spinach.
Wow.
Come on, Stephen S.
You're the boss, Stephen.
Did you hear that?
Oh, hell.
From the creative minds behind 30 Days of Night and the Grudge movies.
Why is this happening?
End of the world. God's flushing the toilet.
That was disturbing. If we don't stop those things from getting to the prom, then our world is over.
Little lady, you'll get the machete.
But I don't know how to shoot a machete.
All right, where y'all going?
To the prom to kick some zombie ass.
There's a certain amount of allegory that has to be, like, zombie movies that are, I won't say they all need to be, they need to be horror comedies or action comedies, but a zombie movie with no irony and no allegory is usually not good.
Right.
The granddaddy of zombie movies was nominally about, I guess you'd say, consumerism. What do people do when they're just shambling, running on instinct? Yeah, they go to the mall.
You know, depending on whose story you believe, real and imagined allegories read into class warfare and race that you see in even Night of the Living Dead, George Romero's original zombie masterpiece.
The Walking Dead is very almost heavy-handedly about sort of the notion of priorities. Like I mean, it says, when is the last time any of us really worked to get something that we wanted? How long has it been since any of us really needed something that we wanted? The world of commerce and frivolous necessity has been replaced by a world of survival and responsibility. So, yeah, I mean, it's right on the tin for The Walking Dead.
Now, I did you know? I did love The Walking Dead comic book that I read. I kept with that story a little beyond where I kind of jumped ship on the TV series. But the one pull quote from, I think it was even the first volume, "In a world ruled by the dead, we are forced to finally start living."
Yeah, but I mean, point being, and here the sort of the allegory would be high school conformity. You know, or Maggie, the Arnold Schwarzenegger zombie film,
mm-hmm.
where there's some sort of subtext about acceptance versus defiance in the face of sickness. We all kind of know in real life, you can take out any number of zombies with a large bin of ball bearings or you know, just a good hard freeze. We know that they don't hold up that well on examination.
Right.
Unless they're your Fulci school, like, magically powered voodoo zombie that never stops, the kind you have to incinerate.
And even then you go into a Return of the Living Dead zombie, which you incinerate, and that just gets in the rain and infects everybody, and yeah, you know.
Then you got naked zombies.
Love them naked zombies. So, basically, the point we're getting at is we have a lot of zombies. There's a lot of ways to do a zombie movie. In this particular case, now I'm putting words in the director's mouth here, so forgive me if I'm totally off base here, but what we have is kind of, we're at this era in 2007, 2008, where we've seen enough zombie movies that we know the tropes. We know how this goes. We've seen enough teen comedies that we've seen the tropes. We know how this goes. And so what we have is a play on all of those tropes, some that we're going to find familiar and comfortable, some that we are going to take to the nth degree and make absurd. And one of the best things about Dance of the Dead is the fact that they have upped the ante on the zombies. And so where we start with George Romero's kind of shambling, slow zombies, and then moved into the Danny Boyle or Zack Snyder kind of fast zombies, we have taken it another peg ahead. The Dance of the Dead zombies literally explode out of their tombs. And so that's kind of what we're talking about. It's like it knows enough that it gives the nod to a girl trapped in a car in a cemetery like Dawn of the Dead, or a group of kids who are in the middle of a zombie apocalypse and they're trapped in a funeral home, and that's tossing back to Return of the Living Dead. But it's still enough of its own thing that you're not watching this as being a facsimile or one of those parody movies, one of those really awful, we don't like to say their names, but you know what we're talking about.
The movie people.
And so what we have is just, it's a really clever parody that manages to play on these tropes, but still manages to be its own thing, which is very refreshing. The only points I can really dock Dance of the Dead on are budgetary, and it's really unfair of me to do that. Some of the special effects in here look better than some of the others, and honestly, that's a very narrow quibble for me. And I think there's a lot of substance here. There's a lot of comedy. I think people are going to enjoy it.
Here's the thing about budget that always comes up in this kind of discussion. Like, right back to, one of the kings of low budget Austin cinema, which was El Mariachi.
Right.
Low budget movies work fine if they're good otherwise. We all grew up, I suppose they were big budget at the time, but certainly many older, very effective movies prove that you don't need what you need a budget to do is not ruin your suspension of disbelief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here we have humor elements and meta elements that buffer our suspension of disbelief anyway. That's another thing a lot of people screw up is I firmly believe it happens when they don't mean to do it at first. It happens when they get halfway into a shoot, realize their footage looks ridiculous. So they try to like kind of retool into a comedy, which is a thing I've kind of seen where like they veer their production into a horror comedy because frankly what they were getting just didn't look as serious as they wanted at first.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't make me immediately come up with an example. I'm
Birdemic. Birdemic is an example of that.
I think a lot of the stuff released under Latter Day Trauma auspices are definitely kind of in that category. Well, and a good horror comedy is something that's a little bit, the elements have to function. The comedy has to function alone and the horror has to function alone. And you get like a Hatchet or a Rise of Leslie Vernon or something.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's some actuality to both.
And I think you get that here. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Like particularly when I jumped on board very quickly was when the zombies showed up. And all of a sudden, because the zombie designs here are pretty good. And the shooting style that was not, like if it was going to be a high school movie that was shot in this fashion, I wouldn't necessarily have been on board. But it lent itself to keeping the monster in the dark, you know, kind of the Thing style.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Where the practical effects were moving and were coming at you out of the shadows. Once it got down to business, this got pretty good.
Before we get too far into it, we should probably give you a quick synopsis. What you're looking at is your ensemble of characters from your teen comedy. So you've got your group of science fiction nerds. You've got your cheerleader who is, her date is sick to the dance. You've got virtually every after school special scenario starting to play out over the montage of the first few minutes as we establish our characters. And they're not afraid to be millennial teenagers either. These are people who look like they grew up listening to Good Charlotte or, you know, maybe a hair behind where we were. They're not contemporary with us. You know, teenagers are teenagers, and this is kind of that tail end of the really tropey high school films that we've come to know and love. And so we've got also the rebellious rock and roll band. We've got, and you know, they're trying out to play at the prom and they're too dang loud in a scene right out of Back to the Future. You've got, you know, your reluctant hero character who is misunderstood and has made some mistakes and is going to go through some arc and redemption. You've got the nerd who's in love with the cheerleader and it's this unrequited thing. I mean, just every situation you can think, the girl who's obsessively wanting to become a prom queen gets screen time in this movie. And so it's all this setup, and it even goes to the big montage with everybody getting ready for the dance, and then things go horribly, horribly wrong elsewhere, as it is discovered that...
But yeah, it is an underground pollution problem.
Yeah, they get an underground pollution problem from the power plant, who is dumping some... I don't know if they come right out and say it's nuclear, but it is definitely toxic. And so you've got that... your basic green slime scenario has entered into the ecosystem, is getting into the soil, and is reanimating dead tissue in the cemeteries. And as those zombies come to life and begin to run amok on the town, they create more zombies. And this is how these things happen. So our heroes kind of bumble their way through the town, collecting their ragtag group of survivors. And among them is Justin Welborn, who's playing in this role. It's he's the troublemaker kid. He's the kid that was probably held back a few years. You know, he's the town bully, I guess, in the principal's office a lot. Probably scares the principal more than the principal scares him. The type of guy who has a lot of urban legends flying around about him.
I heard Crump's brother has steel-toed boots. The Stoned Age, it is a borderline mockbuster to Dazed and Confused.
Uh-huh.
But there's a bully in it who the urban legend about him is that, and it's in my opinion perfectly designed, because it's the exact kind of thing that kids would think is a big deal. But it's they want to, the protagonists meet these girls that have sort of been dibsed by one of their older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The big urban legend about the older brother is that he has quote unquote steel toed shoes and will kick the crap out of you with them. which you know, as an adult, like it's so goofy, because you understand that everybody with $50 can go get that.
Yeah.
You know? but when you're a kid, that seems so malevolent, you know.
So Justin Welborn plays Kyle, and he's a fun character in this. He probably has some of the best lines of the movie. You know, they get their team together, and then they finally descend upon the gymnasium, which, of course, being the noisiest and the most populated part of this small town, that's where all the zombies ended up, and there's this big final showdown. And really, this movie is just, it's a lot of fun, and that's what you're in store for. You know, maybe there was some grand allegory here, and you know, it's art, it's what you interpret. But if you want to go in and just watch this as a fun movie on a Saturday night, I don't think anybody's going to be disappointed. As a matter of fact, I've always been pleasantly surprised when I break this out in like a party scenario, or if I have a couple of people over. This is a good crowd pleaser. It's got just enough gore and horror to keep those fans interested. It's got enough of the teen stuff that those people will be interested. And everybody I talk to when I show this to them, they're like, you know what? I ended up liking that a lot more than I thought I would. And so it's a really fun film.
The one thing I would caution is, I guess if the successful filmmaker that made this asked me as a non-filmmaker for my advice, I would say a few more beats up front to clearly put the, not the horror comedy, but the fact that it was also going to parody some of the teen stuff. Because for me, like, the older you get, the more the line between parodying teen trends and just actual teen trends becomes blurry. These kids with their Kardashians make me feel like Tiny Rick. My real body's dying in a vat, Trevor.
Well, it is important to say that Greg Bishop has gone on to do some really fantastic work. Specifically, so let me just run down the timeline here. Now, we're going to talk about The Signal in just a minute. But what we're looking at is I should have written this down, but so chronologically speaking, the first movie to come out is The Signal. And The Signal has three directors, but among them is David Bruckner. David Bruckner would later go on to do another horror anthology film called VHS. His segment in VHS was called Amateur Night, and it is arguably the best segment in VHS as a whole, was later spun off into a film called Siren, which was just released last year, starring Justin Welborn and directed by Greg Bishop, who directed Dance of the Dead. Now, to further kind of stir the pot here, we also have Bruckner also had a segment in Southbound, which you and I enjoyed. We had a video on that one on our Facebook page. His segment in Southbound features Justin Welborn in a voice-only role.
Yeah. Well, we have a chain of collaboration here between these people that goes back to sort of some of their early freshman and sophomore work together that led them to collaborate first on some anthologies and then some longer projects. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah. So basically, what you're looking at is between Dance of the Dead and the VHS franchise, I guess you could call it that, with the three films in the VHS series and then Siren as a spinoff movie, you're looking at these guys working together a lot, which is something I like to see because it means that you're looking at a truly collaborative team, people who know each other, who know how to work with each other, who maybe will have a shorthand to develop a better art. And you're looking at things less from the perspective of, oh, we should hire this person because they're a box office draw. We should hire this person because they're taller than this actress, etc. You know, it makes it seem more personal and more sincere, which is something I certainly get from Dance of the Dead, because I think everybody in this movie is having a blast. And if they're not, it doesn't come off that way. I mean, this movie looked like so much fun to make.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I think there's a lightness here that comes in. And there's a lot of weird little mini arcs in it that by the end of it, you're very won over. And you're won over by people that, honestly, in the first third, I found kind of grating and didn't know if I would be able to tolerate a whole movie of them. So, and then there's some stuff that's just zany, like the mutual zombification scene.
Well, and that's the thing, is it manages to be a teen movie, it manages to be a zombie movie, but the overlap is so well blended that there are implications that when the guy gets the girl, there's also the trope of, oh, but the people we love are zombies. I mean, it goes on and on. And I don't want to, you know, the worst thing you can do to a comedy is overanalyze it. So I don't want to get too deep into it, but it really is just worth checking out. I do want to specifically point out, however, Justin Welborn in the film, who I think I really keyed into this character for one, because he seems like a dude we would have gone to school with in the great American Rocky Mountain region. I mean, I knew guys like this. Did you? You probably were somebody like this, weren't you?
Oh, I wouldn't. No, not really. I was kind of an odd sort of ultra loner as a kid. I was very, I suppose, when I was the age these kids were, I definitely knew some guys like that, but I don't think they would have claimed to be one. No, he was, there's a little bit of like the sort of, didn't you break my arm when we were kids?
Yeah. Hey, you remember junior year when you, you remember junior year when you broke my arm because you said I looked at you funny? Remember that?
Man, that was you?
Yeah.
Man. Good times.
Yeah.
How's your arm?
Not good, actually. Kyle, I hate to admit it, but I'm actually glad you're here. You're the biggest badass I know.
There were definitely times when we got kind of rough and tumble, and I don't think, I think depending on what sort, which side of your growth spurt you were on, you might not remember it as play where the other person does.
You're looking at archetypes. You're looking at teen movie archetypes. You know, this guy, he's unique. He's definitely his own character. Kyle is his own character. But he definitely echoes a lot of characters that we've seen before in films like this. He's kind of that gearhead, that guy who's in shop class a lot. What he is, he's Heath Ledger in 10 Things I Hate About You without the charm. You know, he doesn't have that kind of softener belly. You know, he's... We do get a little slice of his emotional side. We see him kind of having a very emotional reaction to some really bad. But for the most part, he's just kind of that tough dude that carries a butterfly knife, has steel-toed boots, and you know, owns a gun.
He brought a lot to it, and he's sort of in the absence of. There's really only one other figure in the movie that you'd call an adult per se, and he is also kind of a gym teacher caricature.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he is so, literally Coach. So, I mean, that's his character. He is Coach.
So he's sort of the default adult while he's on screen, even though he's probably only supposed to be a senior, you know?
Yeah.
But we kind of picked these because they're two well-born collaborations that really, like we were touching on earlier, launched a lot of ships. And so should we get on to the other one?
You know, I think so. Any last thoughts, though, on Dance of the Dead before we move on?
Give it a chance and watch it for what it is, and you will probably have some good chuckles indeed. And you see a lot of people do some quality, I won't even qualify it with like an early work or a that kind of thing. It's more than you think, more than you think you're in for.
Now, actually, Matt, when we were pre-gaming, you did bring up something that I did kind of want to examine a little bit. And you're talking about the evolution of the teen comedy and why we're maybe not seeing as much of that anymore. Is that something you wanted to get granular about? Or?
Well, we did kind of discuss a little bit. Like, this was, you know, there was kind of a sequence of movies. Like, what was the, obviously, the teen comedy itself is kind of a uniquely American subgenre. And it goes back to, like, you know, you got the classics like Revenge of the Nerds and Porky's. And arguably, maybe... maybe Animal House, although they're not teens and it's a little more racy and self-aware.
The young person raunchy comedy, though, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess the college aspect of it is sort of like the, you know, like the even The Simpsons makes fun of the fake rivalry with the dean, you know? Those are some very beloved movies, but they kind of age funny. And it's because right around this time, like maybe... I think we pinpointed the start to maybe be Mean Girls or Jawbreaker, which were another couple of like career Nexus movies where you saw a lot of people that would go on to become movie stars. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, on those are the parodies. And then you had the serious ones, which they stepped their game up a little bit, too. And you got like Can't Hardly Wait and American Pie, where they really brought a little more production quality and re-mainstreaming to that. And then I would say American Pie is the one that brought it back. That was 99?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then some of the other stuff lagged behind it, and then you got kind of a new skewering. And of course, like the two that leapt to my mind were Mean Girls, Easy A. There was another one called Jawbreakers that was almost more like Heather's level mean.
Mm-hmm.
You had this set of movies that kind of breaks down, and like I think like you were telling me you haven't seen it, but if in the 21 Jump Street sort of parody relaunch, when they send the guys that went to school in the 90s to infiltrate the high school in the late aughts, they're falling back on kind of wrestler versus nerd tropes, and the kids just flat out tell them like, dude, what do you mean? Why are you telling this kid like he shouldn't talk to a, like the whole culture of cliques had changed a little bit. And we were kind of discussing without much of a way to do anything about it. What are we going to do? Go like take a poll among high school students. But I think that the cliques themselves, I would make a case that they really weren't as much of a thing as you ever thought to begin with.
Well, they certainly weren't this level. I mean, where they were so separate and so diverse and so unique and apart from each other, yet all of the people get along and still hang out at the one common place. That never happened.
There's two things really backing that up, and that was The Outsiders and then The Breakfast Club. Like that.
Honestly, yeah, The Breakfast Club is probably the prototype where it's like, yes, you, in order to be commercially viable to the largest number of teenagers possible, you've got to have a proxy for each of these cliques. So that's when you have a brain, a basket case, a princess, a criminal, a jock, and you put them all in the same movie together. Now, granted, that was the whole thrust of The Breakfast Club, is how do these people get together and interact when they're not supposed to?
It was the outsiders that actually named them greasers, burnouts, jocks, and socias. Mm-hmm. And that slang persisted long into the 80s, although the outsiders is actually set in, what, the 60s? There'd be a whole episode in that one, too, about the sort of semi-veiled authorship of the outsiders and being set a little bit out of its own time. Not unlike the Warriors that we covered in a previous episode, mm-hmm. where by the time the person who wrote the book developed the book, wrote the book, published the book got famous, the book got optioned, that it was already out of date by the time it hit theaters. So ultimately, I think what we had is just the upshot of what I'm saying, I guess. If slap me right now and tell me to stop rambling, I guess what I'm saying is you could no longer get away with painting teen ensembles that broadly anymore.
And so do you think that's
about,
do you think that's why you were kind of turned off by it at the beginning?
Well, at first, nobody warned me that I was not told there would be comedy. So I was kind of like, oh, they better go somewhere with this pretty fast. But then ultimately they did. So I was talked down from my ledge.
So our second film in the podcast episode, which is actually the first film, chronologically speaking, is the 2007 horror sci-fi thriller, The Signal. Now, once again, I can't emphasize this enough. This is The Signal from 2007, not The Signal from 2014. Which is arguably, I think, had kind of a higher visibility for it. I think it had a wider release model. But I personally think The Signal from 2007, they're hard to compare because they're two different films, but I do think I enjoy the 2007 Signal more.
They're not even the same lane. Like it's a pure naming coincidence. They have almost no elements in common.
Yeah.
They're both films about things that happen to people.
And so what we have with The Signal, this is what I'm liking about this group of filmmakers, and it's kind of nebulous, you know, it's not the one group making all these movies. It's just, you know, one guy from this movie went on to work on this movie, and then a guy from that movie went on to make the spinoff, and another guy made the sequel. But, you know, it's all these people who kind of ebb and flow and come around. In this particular instance, you're looking at The Signal, which is it is a horror, or it's a horror sci-fi anthology. It's directed by three different people. The stories were conceived of, but the stories all revolve around one central love triangle between three people and kind of their effect on the world around them. However, in exploring this very deep, pensive relationship drama, you've also got the sci-fi horror element of the fact that you're looking at a yet another kind of zombie apocalypse where a signal has come through all of the electronic devices on the planet, and exposure to this signal kind of causes you to go insane and become violent. You have this fantastical horror element around this very pensive drama. And in this particular film, the Justin Welborn role is actually, he is the other man in this relationship. He and this woman, they're very in love, they're very into each other, but unfortunately, she is married to another man, in this case played by A.J. Bowen, who is also a fantastic actor that I don't think gets enough attention. And that would be a fine film in and of itself. I think these three actors, A.J. Bowen, Justin Welborn, and Anessa Ramsey, would make a fine, pensive relationship drama, but we do have this other element to contend with, this genre horror element that just makes it that much cooler. Matt, what was your takeaway on this?
I liked, we have a permutation on the traditional zombie, which is a lot of, carries with it some baggage. What this allows them to do is just make their own rules, which are pretty consistently administered, which is always good. And then I like how this is really lean. Now, see, this is something that I think a lot of found footage movies need to learn, is there's no omniscience here. You're on the ground with the people finding out what they know. And because of that, there's a good sense of discovery here. And the exposition happens via action. So there's a lot of show don't tell here. part of like this one, I was honestly, I had watched this when it came out and it was just sort of, I had a middling impression of it. And I was actually, so I believe I texted you at one point, I'm like, man, this is actually really good.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I love this movie.
Because when these people's personalities break down, they don't become foam at the mouth crazy. They basically lose sort of that aspect of executive function that keeps you like, well, I guess you'd call it impulse control. And they get a real creeping paranoia that they rationalize. And so it's like a very, you kind of don't know who has it. And once they figure out that they've all got it, they are still aware something is wrong. And so they, what you're watching is them, it's sort of a logic puzzle, like almost an escape room type thing where they're trying to figure out, we have this, how do we function with it? And, you know, the setup is pretty good. A lot of the little twists and reveals of who is kind of having an episode win are all in service to the plot. They don't feel cheap.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of, that was, you know, something happens and that's just rolled back in a way that's kind of cat scary or jump scary.
We'll go to the country and start a life.
Leave?
Go down to the station. We'll get on a train and we'll get in our own private compartment. New Year's Eve, Terminal 13, Maya and Ben.
That's beautiful.
That was strange. The TV turned itself on.
What's going on? Why isn't anything working? Everybody's out in the hallway.
That's the same sound that was coming through the phone.
What's the matter with you? I turned the TV on and there it was.
One out of two people just started killing each other. They just decided to kill people.
Listen to me, the girl in the car.
Do you hear that?
Did you see where she went?
She was going to find you.
We've got to find her.
Well, and it is also important to note that, you know, that this is a in toto, it's a great film, but we're telling three different stories here from three different points of view, and we genre hop three different times. The names being given to them in the IMDb trivia section, you've got the first segment, or I guess they call them transmissions. There's title cards that'll introduce you to each transmission. The first one is Crazy in Love. That's the David Bruckner one. That is, they're calling a visceral horror. Then you've got Jealousy Monster by Jacob Gentry, which is a dark comedy. And then you've got Escape from Terminus by Dan Bush, which they're calling the apocalyptic love story. So, and I think that's probably a fair description of what we're looking at here. But, I mean, the genre really does hop. You do go from a very serious, visceral horror movie to a really funny black comedy, and then to a really tense genre love story at the end. And it does that transition really smoothly. It takes you a second to figure out what they're doing, and then you're like, okay, I get it. I'm on board. And that's all the thought you give it to it. It's not one of those things that immediately rips you out of the movie as you transition from chapter to chapter.
The decision to sort of sub-genre hop within a tight planned theme makes this stand out against a lot of like pure anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is more like deliberately braided shorter stories. I hate to pick a favorite early in our discussion, but the middle one where they're just bottled up in the apartment, man, that's
the Jealousy Monster one by Jacob Gentry. And you know, that's the dark comedy, and there are some really genuinely funny bits in there. There are some fantastic performances in there. There's fantastic performances throughout. The characters who appear in the middle segment appear in the other two as well. And I think that's something we're looking at, especially when we look at an anthology film, and especially with these filmmakers who have made several of them and have kind of played in just about every aspect. They're, you know, these are filmmakers, they're indie. They're usually lower budget, but, you know, they've really been not afraid to play around and to do things. And so what we're looking at here, this is a more cohesive kind of tighter grouping. You look at some of the VHS movies, and they're a little more scattershot. And then you look at some of the people who share some themes in common with that, and you've got Roxanne Benjamin and David Bruckner working on Southbound, which was another kind of tight grouping where it was obvious that the individual filmmakers and the individual directors who were bringing their own separate visions to these segments worked more in tandem with each other than just, here's your budget, here's your camera, come back when you have a film, which is what you see in some of the VHS, or even probably a better example of that would be more so the first ABCs of Death than the second. I think there was a little more collaboration on the second, but sometimes when you do that, it makes for a real uneven film. It's something I think they nail well down here in The Signal and once again in Southbound.
For sure, there's a difference between, like, we're going to tell a story and we're each going to direct an act, which, you know, they clove here to the three-act structure. I also think this idea suited itself well. It's an isolationist idea. Every person has to approach this problem in an interior way. So we're witnessing the problem solving of the different people, whether they go with it, they fight it, they rationalize their way around it. The nature of the problem is such that they logically should be cut off. And so it lends itself to the shifting perspective. And the other thing I thought this really lent itself well to is, like I said, exposition on the hoof, not just story exposition, but character development, because the way this sort of plague of, atavism works is conductive to letting people's little tics and insecurities out. And so there wasn't a sort of in-play method for them to have exposition. Like, you could develop the character because the way the signal's going to mess with his brain is that his inadequacies and worries are going to come to the forefront and manifest as paranoia. And so you had this real good structure. Even though the characters are kind of everyday people, you get in their heads a lot because what's unique about them, their hopes and dreams, kind of bubbles up during the course of the losing their minds phase of the festivities.
We do have a little bit, and this is something that I know that you particularly enjoy when you see it done well, Matt, is a little bit of unreliable narrator going on here. Because of the nature of this signal and what it does to people's minds, and because of how we're kind of seeing this through several different perspectives, sometimes what we're seeing on screen is what is literally happening. The omniscience is the audience. And then sometimes we're actually seeing the reality as perceived by a sick brain. And so that leads to, it's not an M. Night Shyamalan type of twist, but that does lead to some obfuscation and a little game of chess as the audience kind of strings along for the ride. And I think it's done to very great effect here.
This is like the conversation we've had in the past about the slow burn versus the long fuse. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real difference between an unreliable narrator versus just f***ing with people and rolling back what you did. The Signal does the former. It has an unreliable narrator, but there are hints and there are empirical touchstones that let you, the audience, kind of figure it out. It's not what the Wayne's World Scooby-Doo ending where they just, okay, well, stop, we're rolling it back.
Right.
You know. So I thought elements of unreliability in it are done unusually well, because that's something that's real easy to get ham-handed with.
And I don't want to get too much into spoiler territory, so I'll see if I can tap dance around it here. But I do want to give a shout-out on our Justin Wellborn episode to A.J. Bowen, and we'll just talk about him on Justin Wellborn's episode. But I've got a point here. So A.J. Bowen in this movie, he's a maniac, and he is just selling this role. He is dialed up to 11 on intensity, but knows when to turn the dial on the volume, and just he has a nice, good simmering tea kettle part, and I love it. He's great. He's hammy when he needs to be hammy. He's reserved when he needs to be reserved. Just hits all the right notes. Well, then in turn you take Justin Wellborn, who, because of the nature of this outbreak, I guess is what we'll call it, at some point has to start adopting the mannerisms of A.J. Bowen. So you've got A.J. Bowen delivering this fantastic performance in character, and then you have to take Justin Wellborn playing his character, acting like A.J. Bowen's character, but you're not really sure which one of them is perceiving that, which one is the reality. I mean, it's a very, very nested, very layered performance, and both actors just knock it out of the park.
in their love triangle, AJ Bowen is the husband who is not that great of a dude with his head bolted on straight, right?
Before the movie, you can tell this guy was kind of a dick. You know, before the movie started, before the credits rolled, this is a troubled marriage.
But they also are going behind his back. So there's a lot of motivation to not cooperate that is distinct from the normal. Any time in a horror movie when people get bottled up, they like one of the great failures of a lot of the zombie sort of siege movies is why would you ever leave the siege location? And it always involves just human error, just that people start to fight. And again, here, just the script is a little tighter. They have a reason to fight. So they have a reason to not cooperate. And man, when they finally do fight, ugh. That's...
And what I like is that also that this is a different kind of insane zombie because, I mean, the argument's been going on for years. You know, what is 28 Days Later? Is it a zombie movie? Is it not? Danny Boyle says this. George Romero says this. To each their own. If you want to call it a zombie movie, call it a zombie movie. If you don't. You know, no skin off my nose. But this is not a 28 Days Later rage insane zombie. This is not a Dawn of the Dead undead zombie. This, and it's not even a Pontypool kind of echolocation orally contagious zombie. But
it's a very strange kind of like this. You almost think that if you had a really good day while you were infected with this, you could get through it. Like they seem really rational until the tire gets out of the rut.
You know, it's a fresh take on this, which is what a lot of these other zombie movies that we were talking about early seem to lack. And that is just a fresh, original take on, you know, what's going on. And see, I think a lot of the purity argument that we have as fans, and we do it because it's fun. Nobody is going to lose any sleep over whether or not you call 28 Days Later a zombie film. Nobody's going to lose any sleep over whether or not you call Reanimator a zombie film. Nobody's going to lose any sleep or nobody's going to die. Nothing happens if you call The Signal a zombie film, even though these zombies aren't undead flesh eaters.
Well, except you'll be suddenly besieged by a shambling army of indignant zombie fans.
And that's exactly it, is people start to kind of take that seriously, maybe even take it a little too seriously. And you can get lost in the minutiae when it's like, I really don't care if The Signal is a zombie movie or not. Is it a good movie? Thankfully, yes, it is. It's a very good film. It's good. It's strong because it's not the same type of zombie that we've seen time after time after time again. And so it's okay for zombie movies to be different, and it's okay to think differently about them. And basically, what I'm trying to get at is let people be people. It's okay to like things, and it's okay to disagree. Which I guess is just a grander kind of life piece of advice to begin with. But when you start arguing about minutiae on that level, you're really missing the point. And the point here is this is a fantastic film by a bunch of wonderful filmmakers, performances from a great group of actors, and you can sit down and watch it and have a good time watching it. And then talk about it afterwards. And if you want to have a nice, friendly conversation over whether or not it constitutes as a zombie film, that's fine. When you start getting mad and typing in all caps, and that's when it's like, okay, we missed something in translation here.
You know, upon thought, one thing I really liked about this is that, and it's something specifically that Wellborn and Bowen bring, is these guys don't feel separated outside of their relationship. Lewis, AJ Bowen's character, is an exterminator, which is really germane to the plot in a horrible way. We aren't given the typical like a lot of the time in a love triangle you have the wealthy but detached sugar daddy, or the lovable but unmotivated slacker. Like, these guys are rough socioeconomic equals, and the movie doesn't pick a winner outside of their actual behavior. which is something that drives me nuts in a lot of things with a love triangle of like, well, the only reason that we're supposed to be on this guy's team is because he's the protagonist. He's not actually better. The two of them are just two identical dudes. Like a lot of romantic love triangle movies where there's two men vying for a woman, they're essentially sports movies and the woman's kind of just le trophée.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the two guys in a lot of rom-coms could be buds if they weren't on the other team. And this avoids that real neatly. Like, these guys are their behavior differentiates them in the end. And so it subverts the fact that, oh, by the end of it, you know, oh, they were cheating for a reason because this guy was not a cool guy.
Mm.
You know? And it, again, this is a movie that in the future I'll be using as an example to point out, like, there's no excuse anymore to have a bad script. Like, this movie proves that with a few simple elevations to and drafts of the script, you can just get a better movie than the other times we've seen these elements.
Even just like in some of the improvised weaponry they use. Things that people would throw together at the last minute that may or may not work. You've got the character of Rod, I guess a B character in two of these stories. He takes like a knife holder, sticks a bunch of knives in upside down, duct tapes it to a broom handle, and he's got an improvised, you know, mace that he slashes at people with. Really cool to see some of that kind of ingenuity that we'd say least later see in pop culture with things like Dead Rising, where you can combine two elements to create a better, newer weapon. And so that was fun to see as well. And I also do want to throw out a shout out to some of the actors, because the middle segment, the black comedy, actually involves a couple more characters. We're bookended nicely by Justin Welborn and AJ Bowen and Anessa Ramsey kind of playing in this love triangle. But we've also got, this takes place on New Year's Eve, which I always forget, but the middle segment is a woman before a New Year's Eve party and her husband and their landlord and how they're affected by what's going on with Lewis and Maya and Ben. We've got Sherry Christian and Scott Poitras, I hope I'm saying that right, as Anna and Clark, and both of them are fantastic in this too, in very comedic roles with really dry, snappy kind of dialogue. And I really enjoyed them in this, so I wanted to give them a shout out too.
Rod is another character that he's a really deft misdirect because he's set up to be the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
You think Rod's going to stick around and sort of be the benevolent heavy because he's kind of this jockey guy that they come on that looks like he's going to be on the side of the angels for a while, and he doesn't ultimately prove out, and that's a nice misdirect.
You know, and they use that to good effect at South by Southwest too. Most of the imagery, if I'm remembering right now, it's been 10 years, but the image that they used in their publicity materials and in the program and everything was of the Rod character. And I'm going to butcher his last name, but it's the actor's name is Sar Nauja, something along those lines, Nauja. But it was pictures of him kind of screaming, holding the mace. So you really thought he was going to have a larger role in a much bigger part. So yeah, you're right. That was a fantastic misdirect. Something I did want to point out before we wrap up is, and this was pointed out to me on Facebook by a friend of mine when I said I had been watching The Signal, and it's that The Signal was kind of on the precipice of what's being called Yollywood, and we talked a little bit about this when it came to the filmmakers who made Hush. Atlanta, Georgia is the filming location here for The Signal, and it's in the years since has become a huge production town because of its tax incentives, and it's very film friendly. And so you see things now like The Walking Dead films in Atlanta. That logo that comes up at the end of every episode of Archer that says, Made in Georgia. That's a legitimate thing. There are studios in Georgia now.
Well, and if you think about it, it kind of makes sense because it's an afternoon's drive away from almost every type of terrain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got a wide variety of urban sites, like different... you know, you have water features, you have, you can get to the ocean, you can get to a mountain, you can, you know, it's a sensible hub. So I see why that would come around.
And so, yeah, it is really exciting to kind of see this Hollywood of the South kind of pop up. A lot of people thought that was going to be Austin. And, you know, I have to admit, I was kind of on that camp because I wanted to see Austin do well. Texas just doesn't, it actually got rid of some of its film incentives, and as a result has actually lost some local productions because of it. And so I think Austin's moment may have sailed as far as that's concerned, but it is always good. I honestly will automatically give a film points if it doesn't take place in New York or Los Angeles, just right off the bat. It's like on a scale of 1 to 10, automatically you're going to be at a 2 if your film does not take place in Los, you know, obviously in Los Angeles or in New York City.
There's stories that are about being in New York or Los Angeles, and I sort of separate them from, let's just film it here. We won't have to travel. You know.
Well, it's like, take a look at The Nice Guys or Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. You know, I'm going to pick on Shane Black here for a minute. It's great to see those take place in L.A. Those are very much L.A. stories. I didn't like La La Land, but you're not going to be able to tell La La Land set in Atlanta, Georgia, even though it is technically you could set it there, you know, realistically. But it doesn't have that play. It doesn't have that kind of famous Tinseltown silver screen kind of background to it. There are some movies that it's just obvious. It's like, well, hey, we could go film in Seattle, but it would be easier just to go out on the back lot here. So this is set in L.A. now, and that's always kind of disappointing. Yeah, so yeah. It is good to see production companies, especially smaller productions like this, getting out of Los Angeles and kind of seeing more of the world. And, you know, this is great for local economies, too, because it brings jobs to the area. It brings money to the area. These people are spending money in the hotels. They're spending money in the grocery stores, that type of thing. So I did want to bring that up. Matt, what any closing thoughts before we wrap things up?
I like that this is a unique and different sort of, I won't even say zombie, let's call it a horde movie. It's a unique sort of breakdown, and I like what we learn about the characters over the course of it, and I gotta give it a shout out for being a New Year's Eve movie, of which there aren't that many.
Yeah, we were actually kind of up against a wall. We were trying to come up with some New Year's Eve movies, and I mean, there's a few. We could certainly do something, but it was like, yeah, it's not as easy as when you're trying to come up with a Christmas film.
Offhand, there's Strange Days, which actually would be an okay double feature with this, but man, that's a bummer episode.
So I can't think of a better segue than that to get into the if-then portion of the section. Matt, do you have any... I mean, we've kind of made a few recommendations throughout, but let's collect them all here. What are you thinking? If people liked Dance of the Dead, if they liked The Signal, where should we point them?
Well, I'm gonna take the obvious two, we're just gonna get them out of the way, and neither of us are gonna get to count them officially. the obvious two here are Pontypool and Shaun of the Dead.
Okay,
which are. Your brain's almost inevitably drawn to as you watch these. I would say check out the other collaborations they did. I hesitate because, in total disclosure, I haven't actually watched Siren yet.
You know, we were talking about that, how it's kind of that one snuck up on us in December and we just hadn't gotten around to it yet. And we had almost both watched it of our own volition earlier in the week. But, you know, time and schedules being what they are, you know, we never got around to it. And then when we were doing this episode, we're like, hey, man, maybe we should have squozed that in. But we decided, you know, hey, we'll leave that to you, the viewer. You know the people behind it. We've given you kind of a background, and you can go search for their respective previous works. Make up your own mind. Decide if you want to see Siren. And you, if you step on it, may even be able to watch it before we get around to it. So you can discover that
it was
parallel with us.
It was certainly my favorite segment in VHS.
Certainly my favorite in the first one. Now I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna call anybody out, you know. But when you look at a horror anthology like that, you definitely have some that hit harder than others. And Siren, I think, is one of the ones that consistently, when I talk to people who have seen VHS, is usually their favorite. Justin Welborn and Greg Bishop got together for VHS Viral, which is the third installment in the VHS series. Their segment, well, I don't know if it was my favorite, because Nacho Vigalondo has one in there that is just off the wall bonkers, but it's definitely one of the good ones. One of the stronger ones, one of the ones you're going to walk away with. And it's because, again, they get a little original with it. If you're not familiar with the VHS franchise in a nutshell, it's a found footage horror anthology, but it seems like they have kind of a high bar for entry because they usually make the people get pretty creative with why somebody is carrying the camera, why we're in this situation, why we're using this device to tell this story. And they do get really creative with that in the segment that Greg Bishop and Justin Welborn did, which is called Dante the Great, and it's about a magician who has an enchanted cloak that allows him to do his magical tricks and kind of the corrupting force that's behind that. But it's done in the style of like a behind-the-scenes documentary, which is why they have the cameras on him. So it's kind of an interesting, neat take. It's not teenagers with camcorders and cell phones. It's actually a professional camera crew. And so once again, that's just showing how these guys just... they're more experimental. They're not afraid to do things a little differently. And so that's why these are filmmakers that I personally am excited to kind of keep up with and follow.
I have to say, in VHS Viral, I couldn't help but enjoy Bone Storm, the one with the skateboarders.
You and Scott Weinberg. Scott Weinberg, who writes for Playboy and a couple others, he's a friend of ours, loves Gas Money Kid from the Bone Storm segment of VHS Viral.
Which I don't know if I would call it my favorite, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. That's the point. That's the point of the VHS films is you're just going to pop them in and have a good time.
Like a cheeseburger. A cheeseburger is not the greatest cuisine in the world, but it might be my favorite.
Right, know? Right. You know? So, yeah, I mean, any of the collaborations, VHS, VHS Viral, Southbound, please check out Southbound. Southbound is a fantastic film. Yeah, so I think we've given you guys enough ammunition. I think it is time to send our guests here in the diner off into the night and to discover the story and take the story beyond where they found it. Matt, any we've given our last thoughts on the films, but any closing thoughts just in general? How you doing?
I'm doing decent.
Good.
I'd say I'm doing decent. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. The new job's great. For those of you unaware, I have returned to the windswept and snow-blasted wastes of central Wyoming. However, it's feeling pretty good. I'm having a good time. I live like half a block from a movie theater and then like two blocks from two more movie theaters. So it's a great place for me to be. Feeling pretty good. We're getting kind of back into the groove here on the Nighthawks podcast and really enjoyed our Oscar coverage. And if you haven't had a chance, you can go back and listen to that. We had Cameron Maris on as a guest. We're working on getting some guests on in the months to come. So watch this space for details. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher. And you can find us on a variety of other podcast aggregates, and it would be especially helpful if you did and left ratings and star reviews and that type of thing. So, yeah, find us that way. Otherwise, find us on Facebook, Nighthawks Podcast, or on our website where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes over at nighthawkspodcast.com.
Please consider telling everyone you know about our podcast. You know, people, if you think maybe someone doesn't want to know about our podcast, just tell them anyway. You know,
it doesn't cost nothing. Just,
I mean, if people are like, hey, shut up about that, those are bad people. Cut them out of your life. Get new people. Tell them about the podcast.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Justin Welborn is a name to keep up with. We didn't want to say too much about him because we want people to kind of, you know, if they're not familiar, we want to kind of find them on their own. But he has a fantastic performance in both these films. They are different performances. Signal is a very nuanced, very emotional, very raw, very genuine performance. And then you've got Dance of the Dead, where he's fantastically hilarious, troublemaking redneck, I guess. And so it, I mean, it shows a Bryan Cranston kind of level of range that I think, you know, in a few years, we're going to be hearing some really fantastic stuff from this guy.
Does Justified need our help?
You know what? I don't care if it does, because Justified is an incredible show. If you haven't checked this out, it was on FX. It just wrapped up, last year, 2 years ago. Timothy Oliphant, it's the series where I discovered Walton Goggins, and he's fantastic. Recognizable character actress Margot Martindale is phenomenal in the second season. Justin Welborn is great in the fifth and sixth season. I mean, it's just, it's really a wonderful show if you like your crime procedurals just this side of backwoods hick noir, I guess would be a way of putting it. And really, it's just, it's like eating frosting. It's just, you want it so much. It's just, it's rich. I love it.
Like On Stuff, right, Trevor?
What's that?
On Stuff? You like frosting on stuff?
Yeah.
You don't just eat it, right?
No. Of course not. Of course not. No.
All right, first things first. Coach wants to go to the Pancake House. There we'll all have breakfast and juice on Coach. Then we'll discuss stage two of this op. Sound good?
Pancakes are cool.
Roger that.
We're running with the shadows of the night. So baby, take my hand, it'll be all right. Surrender all your dreams to me tonight. It'll come true in the end.